remark of a very simple nature, and presumably many people know the history of the subject, but I still will repeat it. And then I will give a simple presentation, mostly in the, well, almost exclusively in the field theoretic constants context, with very little reference to the string theory, and mostly at the heuristic level. I will try to convince you that a certain way out from the terrible dilemma exists. It's like a demonstration proof. It may be not yet at the level of a realistic model, but still it shows that it's possible to solve the problem. Please do feel free to interrupt me at any time and ask any questions you find appropriate or maybe even inappropriate. I will try to answer anyway. So let me remind you that the cosmological term was introduced almost 100 years ago by Einstein himself when he was deriving his theory of general relativity. He was the first to note that besides this standard Einstein term, which he also wrote, there is a term which is even of higher dimension, and therefore it should have been written in the first place, namely the term with no curvature at all, which is square root of g times lambda. Lambda in four-dimensional theory has dimension of mass to the fourth power, and this term is called the cosmological term. Now you can derive the Einstein equation. Of course, the cosmological term will appear in the Einstein's equation along with the standard Einstein term. Einstein himself didn't like the cosmological term for many reasons, and of course one of the apparent reason why he didn't like it, because nature doesn't seem not to support it. For a very long time, basically since Einstein, it was believed that because our universe is at large distances is very flat, it's Minkowski, and it was believed that lambda is exactly equal to zero. And this vanishing of the cosmological term after the advent of the field theory in the 30s and 40s presented a major problem to the field theories, because in any sensible field theory, as you know, the vacuum energy density, which is the cosmological term, diverges as a fourth power of the momentum. If you introduce some kind of an ad hoc cutoff on the divergence, then you get something, naturally get for the cosmological term, something of order of the fourth power of the momentum cutoff. What I want to say now, that other great minds besides Einstein were deeply involved in the problem and considered this problem to be a serious concern to the field theory. In particular, Pauli, shortly after the Second World War, Pauli delivered delivered his famous course of lectures on modern particle physics, modern at 1948. This course was worked out into five volumes. It was published as five volumes in the 70s. And if you open the last volume, there is a discussion of what happens to the vacuum energy density in field theory, and Pauli mentions that that's a serious problem and nobody knows how to solve it. Also, he mentions in passing, and it shows that great minds can have insights much before their time. He shows in passing that, of course, if you have a field theory in which the number of the boson give a positive contribution to the vacuum energy density, fermions give a negative contribution. And he mentions in passing if the number of the boson and fermion degrees of freedom exactly match, you may get a consolation. So in a sense, that was a remark which can be viewed as a precursor to supersymmetry. Well, after Zeldovich, after Pauli, many other people tried to address this problem with not much success. I personally remember the investigations in high energy physics starting approximately from 1970, when I started working on my master's degree. And I remember that around this time Zeldovich spent like 2 years of his life thinking, concentrating, focusing on the problem of the cosmological term. And the best, after 2 years of heavy research, the best explanation he could come with was the so-called anthropic principle, namely, one assumes that there is a large variety of universes and the cosmological term is scattered more or less randomly in various universes. It has distinct values. However, in those universes where it is not abnormally small, there are no experimentalists to think over the issue, and only in our universe, for some reason we don't understand, it's abnormally small and it just happened to be so. Of course, this is not a scientific approach then, because if that's the case, there is nothing to explain for theorists. We should just take this for granted. Well, a new kind of a new impetus to the problem was given with the advent of the, well, the second advent of the string theory in 1985, when there was a famous paper by Witten, Candela, Strominger, that the string theory explained is the theory of everything. If it is the theory before that, more or less one might hide oneself behind the principle that, okay, field theory is not a closed theory anyway, so who knows what happens at short distances. When somebody comes and says here is the theory of everything, then one should explain, of course, give answers to all issues, and the issue of the cosmological term, as we will see on the next transparency, is the most acute, because the discrepancy here between theory and experiment is 60 orders of magnitude at least. It's probably the largest ever discrepancy we have in physics. At the initial stages in the 80s, the impression was that the string theory will solve everything and this problem in particular. At this point, I should say only that it's not solved in string theory till present, and it's not ruled out that for some unknown reasons, because we don't know how exactly string theory operates at very short distances, it's not ruled out that there is a kind of an overall conspiracy which we totally don't understand and have even no hint how it works, but since we don't know what's going on there, one can always say there is an overall conspiracy which takes care of the vanishing of the cosmological term at very short distances. And I think that maybe Keith Dinas is going to talk about this possibility. At least he wrote a couple of papers devoted to this subject, which are technically, I think, very interesting, although I don't know whether they are relevant to nature. In fact, as I will explain you on the next transparency, the situation became, in the last 2 years, the situation became much worse. Rather than improving, it became much worse. Not because of any theoretical development, but rather because of the experimental development. Till recently, people believed that the cosmological term is exactly zero. The vanishing of the cosmological term, the exact vanishing of the cosmological term, was consistent with the observed flatness of the universe at large distances. Now, what happened in the last 2 years is that there were a couple of experiments which observed, I'm not going to go into the details of experiment, I will just say what follows from this experiment, and people observed some kind of acceleration of distant part of universe, and almost inevitable explanation of this result is that, in fact, the cosmological term is not zero. It does not vanish, although it's very, very small. If you try to interpret this acceleration in terms of four-dimensional theory only, without invoking any extra dimensions, then you can estimate the observed result by assuming that the cosmological term or the four-dimensional vacuum energy density is 10 to the minus 3 electron volt to the fourth power. Okay? Now, as I said, theoretically, one should expect the fourth power of the cutoff for the very same quantity. And a natural cutoff would be the Planck scale. If you have a supersymmetric theory with softly broken supersymmetry, with some twisting of arms, you can lower down the cutoff to the fourth power of the supersymmetry breaking parameter. I shouldn't say that it's not automatic, but maybe you can do it. That's the lowest the present-day theory can go. So let's call it, quote-unquote, a natural value of supersymmetry breaking, although, as I said, I mean, you have to work hard to make this theoretical estimate that small. Natural, I mean, if you don't think of anything, you would get rather m sub z squared times some ultraviolet cutoff squared, which is larger. So natural value is TeV to the fourth, and you see that the difference between these two numbers is 60 orders of magnitude, and the more so because it's not vanishing, according to the modern experimental data. And by now I should say there is not one but two experiments which seem to indicate. It's very hard. I mean, zero could be explained, after all, by imposing some symmetries which are not clear, the origin of which are not clear at the moment. But if you have to explain a very small but non-vanishing number, it's real hard. Even if you take out the fourth power, I mean... Well, the fourth power of mass is the natural unit for the cosmological term. So, I mean, masses are measured linearly in GeV, and cosmological term is of the fourth power. What can I tell? I mean, it's because our world is four-dimensional. So, but of course, I mean, you can take the 12th power if you want, and then the problem is not so drastic. But physically, it's the same problem. Okay, you can also reformulate it. The very same number, the four-dimensional vacuum energy density is probably, I should reformulate it in terms of the curvature of the universe at large distances, because this number is heavily relies on the four-dimensional interpretation, and in what follows I'm going to go to higher dimensional worlds. Therefore, I would not like to rely on this number, and I would say rather that the curvature of the universe, which is of order of h squared, turns out that the curvature of the universe h squared turns out to be, for some also mysterious reasons which we don't understand why, but that's not the essence of my problem, turns out to be of order of the present day Hubble, which is 10 to the minus 33, h is 10 to the minus 33 electron volt, and r is of order h squared. So please remember this number, because we are going to return to it later. So as I have mentioned, 90 years of hard work didn't bring much success to theorists in the understanding of the cosmological term. There are only so far, if you look through the literature, you can find only two hypotheses or conjectures. One is the overall ultraviolet conspiracy, of which I think Keith Dinis is going to tell. Well, he is, of course, trying to get epsilon 4 equal to 0. We know that it has to be slightly non-zero. Another is the anthropic principle, which sort of crystallized in the 70s, and it's still there. I mean, if any of these two solutions, I mean, are beyond science, because we don't know, I mean, there are no questions we have to ask or answer if any of them takes place. It just happened, okay? So in my talk I will still assume that this is a scientific kind of physics question which may be addressed, and some mechanism should be sought for in order to explain the problem of the extreme flatness of our universe. The basic idea which I am going to pursue in some detail is the idea of so-called offloading. The idea, in a very vague and general form, it's also a rather old idea, because it dates back, I mean, it was mentioned in passing in a Wetterich paper of 1982, which was devoted to some other issues, just one sentence, and then it was also mentioned in passing, although a little bit more in a detailed manner, with no mechanism suggested, but just as an idea, by Rubakov and Shaposhnikov in 1983. The idea is very simple, and I would say aesthetically extremely appealing. It says that let's assume that the four-dimensional energy density is still of a natural, quote-unquote, order of magnitude, which I will take as TeV to the fourth as the natural estimate. With some effort, you can get, in field theoretic approach, TeV to the fourth as the natural estimate. But then, so it's a pretty larger number, and then how to reconcile it with the flatness of the universe. The answer is you have to write the Einstein equations not in four dimensions and in five dimensions, and then you have to offloading means that the major impact of relatively large epsilon 4 goes into curving of extra dimensions rather than our fourth dimension. So if you are lucky, you can maybe arrange your world in such a way that epsilon 4 is of a natural order of magnitude, then you write down the Einstein equation. These are multidimensional rather than four-dimensional equations, and the curving goes into the perpendicular dimensions. Since we are creatures which live on some kind of topological defect which stretches only in our four dimensions, we don't care about what happens in the perpendicular dimensions, which may be curved enough. What is more important for us is that we know that our four-dimensional world is practically flat. I know Milgram and others. I don't think it raises to the level of a model, you know. Therefore, it's very hard to discuss it. Some other people, it's an old, you know, old attempt. People say that just Einstein's gravity is wrong at large distances for no good reason. Okay. That's okay. I mean, any theory may well be wrong beyond the limit where it was experimentally tested. But if you say that something is wrong, you have to come up with an alternative theory which is right. And it has to be A, internally self-consistent, and B, it has to go through all the set of experimental data we have at the moment. In this sense, Milgram and others who claim that Einstein gravity is just wrong at large distances never came up with any alternative model or mechanism which can be discussed independently, so I don't think it's kind of a serious thing.
You mean at short distances?
No, at large distances. If you are interested in this issue, I can say a little bit more on that, but let me say it before I want to say within this approach, and then we can discuss other large distance modifications. Because in principle, I work a little bit on this Milgram idea and even came forward with some very crazy model which might explain Milgram. But it's crazy. I mean, I must warn you. So if you are ready to listen to crazy things, I mean, that's okay. But first I want to say something which is more in the standard vein. Okay. Now I should say that a new boost to the problem of the cosmological term or a new impetus came after 1997, when the so-called brain world scenarios took off. And as you know already, and also from independently and probably know very well from the previous lectures at this school, that the brain world scenarios are kind of a remake of Kaluza-Klein idea, but in a novel environment. Today on the market there are three basic classes of the brain world scenarios, and I will list those classes because not all of them have to say something new regarding the cosmological term. So historically, the first brain world scenario is the so-called ADD scenario. It tells us that the original assumption is that our world has more dimensions than four. However, there is a four-dimensional topological defect, which in field theoretical context is called domain wall, in the string context is called brain. And all standard model fields are trapped on this brain. When I say standard model fields, it's also standard model, quote-unquote, because what I mean here are all fields like, it may not necessarily be standard model, it can be MSSM, or it can be grand unified MSSM, or whatever. I mean kind of natural generalizations of the standard model. So whatever you might think of as being matter fields, like W bosons, or quarks, or leptons, or Higgses, or axions, they are trapped on the domain wall, or on the brain. And only gravity can propagate in the perpendicular direction, being of universal nature. And then, in order to reconcile the fact that at large distances gravity is four-dimensional, you have to assume that the extra, I mean, at least ADD scenario assumes that the extra dimension is compact. So it's called ADD scenario, also called compact extra dimension scenario. There are well-known mechanisms for trapping the SM fields on the domain wall in field theory, or even more so, it's almost a postulate in string theory, so this is not a problem. What was a problem? Originally, by the way, this idea of localizing SM fields on the brain with some large perpendicular or infinite perpendicular extra dimensions, it dates back to 1982 to Rubakov and Shaposhnikov, and then it was kind of revived in supersymmetric setting in 1986 by Dvalia and myself. What was hard to do in field theory is to, or impossible to do in field theory, to localize gravity. So what ADD says, forget about localizing it, let gravity live in the bulk. And we know that that's natural for the string theory, because in string theory, gravitons are closed strings, so they don't have to be localized on the brain. In order to be consistent, if you want the string scale to be in the TEV range, and I should emphasize that this TEV number doesn't follow from anywhere theoretically, just our desire to bring new physics close to our experimental possibilities and to avoid a hierarchy problem, although it's not, as you will see immediately, it's not avoided, it's just reformulated. The string scale has to be low, then goes from 10 to the 19th GeV down to TeV, and then the size of extra dimension, well, depends on the number of extra dimensions, but it can be in the submillimeter range. The volume of extra dimension is of order of the size of extra dimension to the nth power. The nth is the number of the extra dimensions. And we will see in this type of model there is a one-to-one relation between the fundamental Planck scale existing in the bulk, the visible Planck scale on the brain, and the volume of extra dimension. I will show it on the next transparency. And we will see that this one-to-one rigid relation precludes the cosmological problem from being solved. Now, the second type is called warp extra dimension. It works mainly if there is only one extra dimension. If you have a brain and one co-dimension, then you can write down the Einstein equations. The brain is a source in the Einstein equations, and then you see that the warping of extra dimension is exponential. And because of this, even though the extra dimension, the coordinate here, runs from 0 to infinity, it's not compact. However, the warping is exponential, therefore the volume of the extra dimension is finite. This is the so-called random Sundron scenario, which received much attention since 97, and I'm not going to discuss it because it also doesn't say anything new for the cosmological constant problem. The only important thing for me is it's the volume is finite, and there is a similar relation between the visible Planck scale, the brain Planck scale, and the volume of the extra dimension. Now, why in both cases, when the volume of extra dimension is finite, why it happens that we cannot solve the cosmological constant problem? Well, intuitively it's probably clear, but let me try to be a little bit more formal and explain. In such theories, the relation, okay, M star is the fundamental Planck scale existing in the bulk. That's the true fundamental scale, and then the visible Planck on the four-dimensional domain wall or the brain is related to the volume of the extra dimension, to the parameter n, and the fundamental scale by this famous formula, m Planck squared is equal to m star to the power 2 plus n times the volume. Okay, and this is unavoidable. This formula normalizes the strength of the Newton interaction at large distances. By definition, if you have two gravitating bodies at large distances, the coupling constant It's the Newton law which they gravitate with, and the coupling constant is 1 over visible M Planck squared. In the infinite volume extra dimension, if you have a finite volume extra dimension, what happen? Let's say effective size of the extra dimension is L, then you can always go to distances larger than L. You can have your probe bodies at distances larger than L. And then all Kaluza-Klein modes decouple for such large distances. The existence of higher of the excited Kaluza-Klein modes are irrelevant. The exchange goes only with the lowest Kaluza-Klein mode. You get an effective field theory. And you know how to normalize the interaction, and this gives you unambiguously this relation. Now, what happens if this relation exists? What happens with the cosmological term? Offloading doesn't work. And the true reason for that, heuristic reason is very easy to understand. First of all, supersymmetry must be broken on the brain. We know it empirically. In our four-dimensional world, there is no Bazet-Fermi degeneracy. Although there are some crazy ideas that supersymmetry may be there and there is no Bazet-Fermi degeneracy. For instance, Witten wrote a paper on this subject. If you ask me at the end of my talk, I'll say a few words about this paper. This is a remarkable paper because it references nobody, okay? It's probably the first paper in physics where there are no references at the end of the paper. And it's a very beautiful idea, except that it works only in three dimensions. So if we knew how to implement Witten's idea in two dimensions, after Witten, two-dimensional implementations were found too, but we don't know any implementations in four dimensions. The idea is beautiful, except that we don't know how to implement it in four dimensions. So presumably, supersymmetry would require, in four dimensions, does require Fermi-Bazet degeneracy. We don't see it in nature, therefore it is broken on the brain. Now, the graviton zero mode propagates everywhere in the bulk, and since it propagates everywhere in the bulk, it gives rise to the supersymmetry breaking in the Kaluza-Klein modes too. And you can easily estimate the value of this splitting between the graviton and gravitina Kaluza-Klein modes. And this splitting is of order M Suzy on the brain to the fourth power divided by this, the very same combination, which is normalized. Unfortunately, we know it empirically. It's normalized to a known number. So if you do the division between these two parameters, you get this number, 10 to the minus 3 electron volt squared, and that's the number which was on one of my first transparencies, which naturally occurs in any field theory, which results in a curvature at large distances of this order of magnitude. So it's there is no solution to the extreme flatness of the universe in any in known brain world scenarios with finite extra dimensions. So is there a way out? Here I have to invoke the third class of theories, brain world scenarios, which is called the infinite dimension brain world scenarios. And I will explain, I will focus, that's the my prime concern in this lecture, but let me start explaining things in turn. I will come to more detailed description of what it is, what it really is. What is most for our aspect? What is most important that in infinite volume extra dimension scenarios, this relation between the Planck scale and M star and the volume breaks because the volume is infinite. There is no such relation, and there can be no such relation. Of course, there is a price to pay. The price to pay is in a sense it's a heavy price to pay. On the other hand, it's not ruled out by experiment. What's the difference? What's the technical difference between finite and infinite volume extra dimension? As I said, that in finite volume extra dimension models, you can always go to distances larger than the typical size of the extra or effective size of the extra dimension. When all Kaluza-Klein modes decouple, you are left with only one zero Kaluza-Klein mode, and the gravity behaves itself, everything behaves itself, gravity in particular behaves itself automatically as four-dimensional. Now, if the volume of extra dimension is infinite, strictly speaking, Kaluza-Klein mode never decouples because there is no mass gap for the Kaluza-Klein mode. They accumulate to zero. Therefore, strictly speaking, at no distances, gravity is exactly four-dimensional. So the price you have to pay for the breaking of this relation and the possible resolution of the cosmological constant term is that the gravity is never four-dimensional. It's always 4 plus something dimensional, and you have to make sure that this 4 plus something doesn't contradict experimental data, and we know pretty well that on galactic and even intergalactic scale, there is Newton law which operates. So if there is some deviation from four-dimensional Newton law, which is empirically permitted, it should occur at a scale of maybe 1/10 of the universe size, maybe it's 1/100 of the universe size, but it should be a pretty high scale. And we have to take care that this comes out naturally. So here is the summary of the situation, that all finite volume extra dimension modify gravity only in the ultraviolet at short distances. That's why the experiments which were reviewed yesterday by Professor Antoniadis, they refer to the study of gravity of Newton law at shorter and shorter distances. Okay? If you have an infinite volume extra dimension with no such relation, then you have both modifications. You have a modification of gravity in the ultraviolet, which is roughly the same as another model, so we don't have to care about it because at the submillimeter level nothing is known of gravity. Also, you modify it at very large distances, and you have to explain that this modification is harmless from the empirical viewpoint. However, this is a heavy price, but you get something, and something is the possibility of new solution for the Einstein equation, which curve only in the perpendicular dimensions and do not curve the world in our four-dimensional world. Also, there are some new possibilities for the late time cosmology, which I'm not going to discuss for two reasons. First of all, not worked out till the end, and second of all, I'm not really a great expert in cosmology, so I would prefer to avoid this issue. Another, besides the breaking of this relation, which is crucial for a possible solution of the cosmological constant term, we will need that to have for naturalness. As we will see, we will need to have M star much less than TeV, and again, this infinite dimension brain world scenarios allow for such possibilities. Okay, now I make kind of a step back, because I formulated the goal towards which we are moving, and eventually we'll be there, but at first let me explain, forget for a while about the cosmological constant term, and let me tell you why the infinite dimensional brain world work at all, because at first sight it seems rather paradoxical. So this is an heuristic picture behind this infinite dimensional world. It was already presented here by Professor Antoniadis. This is a domain wall or a brain which represents our four-dimensional world on which all standard model particles are localized. This is the perpendicular direction with a closed string which is graviton moving in the perpendicular direction, except that now I don't assume this direction is compact, and on the contrary, I assume it is infinite. It's non-compact in no way it is compact. It is infinite in terms of the coordinates which you introduce here, and the metric is not warped or very weakly warped, so if you start calculating the volume of the perpendicular direction, it is infinite. In fact, the gravity effects in the perpendicular dimension are pretty weak and can be, in this model, and can be taken into account perturbatively. It's not like Randall syndrome. It's totally in the opposite direction. Okay? So, before I proceed further, let me discuss that I'm trying to be as physical as possible here, in particular I prefer to avoid the string language, and for me this is really a domain wall which is made of something and it has a thickness. The thickness of the domain wall I denote, or rather to say inverse thickness of the domain wall, I denote it by parameter MSM. This parameter tells me at how large energies, and there is an ultra, below MSM we have an effective field theory in four dimensions. As far as all SM fields are concerned, forget about gravity for the time being, we have just a standard field theory with some ultraviolet cutoff. It's clear that because our SM fields are localized on the domain wall, the ultraviolet cutoff is provided by the inverse thickness of the wall. And we assume that the wall is pretty thin. I don't want to say that it's exactly, its inverse thickness is M Planck, but it may be 1/10 or 1/100 of M Planck. It's maybe, so it's pretty thin. There are two reasons why I want to do so, as we will see. One reason, this value of MSM to have at large is crucial for having gravity not modified at distances, say, on the scale of the size of the universe, so weakly modified to only at very large scale, not at the galactic scale. And the second reason, I want to prefer one single success of supersymmetry and physics beyond the standard model we have in the last 30 years. There is only one success of this huge field in which thousands of people worked for 20-something years. That's that given the values of alpha 1, alpha 2, and alpha 3, and given the logarithmic running, they nearly overlap, these three constants nearly coincide at one particular point, which is 10 to the 15th or 10 to the 16th GeV. So I want to keep, there are two natural desires, and these desires work in one and the same direction, and they coincide, therefore I'm very happy. So MSM will be taken to lie in the 10 to the 16 GeV ballpark. Okay, now you may ask me a question. And this seems to be a killer question which rules out the whole approach. Okay, here is my brain. This is probe body number one. This is probe body number two. They live on the brain. They are localized on the domain wall by some mechanism, which we know such mechanism. However, as I said, the fifth dimension is infinite, and the graviton freely propagates in the fifth dimension. So if you start measuring the force or the potential between two bodies, the graviton, which seemingly propagates in the infinite dimension, doesn't know anything about the Newton law in four dimensions. Say, for instance, in five dimensions, the Newton law would be 1 over r squared, rather than, it's the potential 1 over r squared, rather than 1 over r. And moreover, the coefficient would be normalized to the fundamental scale in the five-dimensional bulk rather than four-dimensional M Planck. So nothing seemed to match. It seems that there is, in this type of approach, there is a gross contradiction with experiment just at two levels, the functional form of dependence and also the coefficient. Okay, this conclusion is based on a very naive argument that you have the action written here. You have the standard model part of the action, which is localized on the brain. The quantities with the bar denote the quantities limited to the brain. For instance, G bar is the metric on the brain, on the four-dimensional manifold. And this is the gravity part, which I write only the Einstein part. I forgot to say that in this type of approach, in the approach with infinite volume extra dimension, supersymmetry is exact in the bulk. This is also makes it different because, say, in the ADD approach, supersymmetry is in the for finite volume of the bulk. Supersymmetry is always violated by the graviton zero mode. It's slightly violated, but sufficiently enough in order to destroy the cancellation of the cosmological term. In this approach, supersymmetry can and is exact in the bulk. Therefore, the action starts with the Einstein term, And this what naively one might write, and if one writes only this, that's the end of the story, because then this follows immediately and the approach is ruled out right away. So, okay, of course, since I'm here today and I'm telling you this story, this naive formula is wrong. And the fact that it was wrong was noted in the year 2000 by Gabadadze, Dvali, and Parati. And it's wrong for very trivial reason. In fact, the reason for the wrongness of this formula was anticipated back in the late 60s by Sakharov. It's called so-called the induced gravity. Indeed, what was written on the previous transparency was the classical Lagrangian, but there, of course, even at the theoretical levels, there are loops. The standard model particles, which are confined to the brain, can propagate in loop, and the graviton, which can live in the bulk, is coupled to this loop, and therefore the loops of the standard model particle provides the induced gravity term, which is also limited to the brain surface. Here it is written. It's square root of g bar times m induced squared times r bar. M induced squared is the effective ultraviolet cutoff, which is of order of MSM. So for my reasons, you remember it's MSM is something like 10 to the 16th GeV. It's still not the Planck scale, but you will understand why it's okay. And this is the curvature, also four-dimensional curvature on the brain. Note that supersymmetry does not preclude the occurrence of this quadratic divergence, and moreover, it occurs in any, you can write any reasonable model, it occurs there. Okay? Now we have two terms. We have two gravity terms in the action. The bulk term, which is of this form. This is the 4 plus n dimensional bulk term for the graviton propagating everywhere. And there is this induced term, which is only 4 dimensional. Moreover, as I said, the parameter here, m induced, is much stronger than m star. I will explain shortly that m star has to be a very small parameter, much less than TeV, and m induced, I said, it's naturally, it's of order MSM, which is 10 to the 16th GeV, but then it times the number of degrees of freedom. And there are, even in MSSM, there are a few hundred of degrees of freedom, and if you have further modifications, you have even more. So if you modify 10 to the 16th by the number of degrees of freedom, you can easily imagine a situation that this goes to the Planck scale, that M induced is actually the Planck scale. So if it were not for this term, the gravity would be five-dimensional, extremely strong, you see, because the force is determined by 1 over M star, and M star is a small parameter. So the induced Sakharov's gravity shields the gravity from strong gravity in the bulk, and it makes it weak on the brain. Of course, there is interplay between these two terms. Neither of them is switched off. And you have to make sure that this term wins at distances where we know experimentally that gravity is four-dimensional over this term. Otherwise, the model doesn't work. No, on the brain, supersymmetry is broken. It's non-BPS domain wall. Huh? I will explain this. I will come to the hierarchy problem. We have to make sure that higher loops, that everything is stable against higher loop, and you can easily see that that's the case. Because higher loops, I mean, this big term is already appears at one loop, and higher loops don't change this M induced significantly.
So if you write down any non-normalized response from the brain,
I have to write to them. I will come to that. So far, I only explain what happens to the Einstein terms.
What's the scale of the
TV scale. Okay. So here is the summary of what I said. I don't know, I probably already said everything, but I still show it. Since our lecture is kind of educational, it's better to repeat something than to underemphasize something. So we have now, with the induced Sakharov's gravity, we have basically three terms in the Lagrangian. We have the standard model term on the brain, we have the gravity in the bulk, which is determined, this strength is determined by M star, and we have the induced term, and this is the ultraviolet cutoff, and it should be M squared times the number of degrees of freedom, and we just say that this is 10 to the 19th GeV, this is the Planck scale. Now, here is a partial answer to your question, that the standard model loops renormalizing the brain tension, which is at the same time the four-dimensional cosmological tone, are protected by n equal 1 world volume supersymmetry. And they're cut off at M Suzy. So the loops of the standard model particle produce, no matter how many loops you take, you produce the very same M Suzy to the fourth contribution to the brain tension, which is for the four-dimensional coupling constant. We don't force it lower than M Suzy to the fourth, because M Suzy to the fourth, for our purposes, is an okay natural value, but we have to bother that it doesn't become higher than that. So the bulk loops do not include this. On the other hand, the bulk loop do not include standard model fields. And I remind you that in standard model fields, supersymmetry is broken. And therefore, they are protected by unbroken bulk Suzy. Therefore, the bulk cosmological constant vanishes. Okay, and now you have to worry about the bulk loop renormalizing the Einstein-Hilbert term. They are cut off, of course, you cannot mathematically rigorously show it, but it's natural that they are cut off. All the bulk loops are cut off at the fundamental scale M star. That's the scale where presumably string physics takes off in the bulk. And therefore, in order to make them harmless, as I said, we have to make sure that M star is pretty small, so that all higher bulk loops do not generate large corrections, which then would require a natural fine-tuning or cancellation. This imposes a constraint of M star on the, from above. As we will see, M star have to be less than a fraction, maybe 100 or 1,000 electron volt. So it's pretty strong limitation from above, and we have to make sure that it's okay from empiric and phenomenological point of view. And this is also, of course, this was done naturally, it's okay. But that's what is needed for the theoretical self-consistency of the model. Now we can address the issue, what kind of gravity is generated in this approach. Again, we have two probe bodies, M1 and M2. They are separated at some distance, no matter how large the distance is, because this dimension is infinite and there is no mass gap for Kaluza-Klein excitation, there are always two gravitational mechanisms. There is the kinetic term on the brain induces the gravity exchange along the brain, and the kinetic term in the bulk induces the gravity exchange in the bulk. So the question is when one loop wins numerically. Okay? To do so, in order to analyze this question and to give an answer to this question, you can do it in many different ways. For instance, a good way is to analyze the Green function. And it's in the mixed Fourier transform representation. We Fourier transform with respect to a four-dimensional momentum as far as perpendicular coordinates. We do not Fourier transform, but rather we fix them to line on the brain. That is, y is the perpendicular coordinate, the brain is at the origin, so y is equal to zero. With these two terms in the action, it's rather easier. The inverse quadratic term determines the Green function, and here is the answer, for instance, in five dimensions. In higher dimensions, it's similar. Nothing really changes seriously. And the Green function takes a very simple form. It has, of course, this contribution from the four-dimensional term, which is proportional to M Planck squared, and it has a contribution from higher dimensions, which is proportional to M star. But the powers of momenta are different. This is naturally p squared, and this is square root of p squared. That's why I say in the absence of this term, you get 1 over r squared for the Newton potential rather than 1 over r. Quadratic term, in the absence of this term, of course, produces 1 over r Newton potential. Now you have a critical parameter and interplay of forces with regards to this parameter. It's clear from this formula that the critical parameter RC, it's the, of, has the dimension of distance, is M Planck squared divided by M star to the cube, to the cubic power. If the distances are lower than the critical size, then this term is inessential, because at small distances means large momenta. At large momenta, P squared always win over P. So at large momenta, this term is more important than the size. What is large and what is small is determined by R sub C. So when R is less than R sub C or P is bigger than R sub C minus 1, this term is wins. And we get minus 1 over R. We get four-dimensional gravity. On the other hand, if the distances are very large, the momentum is very small, then P is always more important than P squared. The small momentum of this term always wins. At large distances, propagation in the bulk is always more advantageous than the propagation through the surface of the domain wall or of the brain. And at large distances, you get non-Newtonian, low 1 over R squared. You get five-dimensional gravity. Now, as I said, this is the consequence of the no mass gap for Kaluza-Klein mode, and we have to make sure that R sub C is, say, a order 1/10 of the universe size, so that the Newtonian gravity spoils that distances only of the universe size, and then it's harmless. Okay? It definitely should be there. R sub C should definitely be larger than galactic or even intergalactic distances, because at least this is, we know that the Newtonian law works. So this again gives you another constraint of, because R sub C is determined by this Planck, which is 10 to the 19th GeV squared at M star, this gives you another constraint on M star. And remarkably enough, the solution of this constraint, if you make RC equal to exactly to the size of the universe, you again get 10 to the minus 3 electron volt for M star. So from two different arguments, stability of the radiative corrections and the non-corruption of the Newtonian gravity, you get one and the same number, which is encouraging at the very least. Yes? No, it's... I'm sorry, people always ask this question. You know, I couldn't fit this line on transparency with the minus sign. In fact, of course, it is there. No, it gives the right sign. And in fact, it has to be minus here. You can check that it is minus. And just for typographical purposes, I omitted this minus.
What about the tensor structure? Linearized analysis would always give you the wrong tensor structure.
The tensor structure corrupts also at the very same distances.
The tensor structure is wrong all the time. You get...
No, it's not wrong all the time, because it's at... No, at distances shorter than this, you can just forget about five-dimensional gravity, because everything is determined by the standard Einstein-Hilbert term, which gives you the standard Newtonian force.
What about the brain?
It's not induced, because what is induced on the brain is the standard, it has no fifth component. It is only four-dimensional gravity. Because... it's a trivial thing. In fact, it's very well known in solid-state physics. Whatever is induced on the brain has to be compatible with the symmetries of the unbroken symmetries of the brain. So it's only the standard Einstein-Hilbert term with the standard tensorial structure, with the standard curvature, which is generated.
Can you just apply it mean, in the original Vali Parati
Gabbard paper,
they say that it gives me an additional scale of field on the brain. It gives me the wrong tensor structure for the painting. Right, you didn't write the
upstairs part of. We can discuss it a little bit later, but I don't think that anything wrong comes appears here. We can discuss it later if you want. Yeah. That I presume that's the case. That's people explain it with dark matter. Well, you know, there are ample evidence at this time that dark matter does exist. For instance, gravitational lensing indicates that there are dark matter beyond any doubt. You may argue how much dark matter is there and whether there is enough dark matter in order to explain the rotational curve and the stuff like that. But the fact that dark matter is present in our universe, I think it's beyond any doubt. Excuse me?
He would not have given
you
one of our
architectures. Excuse me?
If you had a rotation curve of the galaxy instead of the orbit of the moon to play with,
yeah.
He would not have said that the potential was one of our
own. Yeah, because he didn't know about dark matter, right?
But I think if you try to explain dark matter by changing the Newton law, then you need to make gravity stronger.
I mean, if there is already a second question about the modification of the Newton law, non-related to any brain world, just in our four-dimensional world, you know, and I will be happy in principle to discuss it with you because I have my own crazy ideas about it, but not at the expense of this lecture. It's an interesting question, you know, indeed, whether and how much of modification of the Newtonian gravity is allowed in our universe, not because of dark matter, but because of something else, and this something else being unrelated to possible extra dimensions. It's just four-dimensional physics. So the distances we talk now are intermediate distances, say galactic distances. Is there something else going on in gravity? Or quote-unquote gravity beyond Newtonian law, say at the galactic or maybe intergalactic distances. And usually people say that besides gravity there is nothing else, and maybe still there is something else, but it's a totally different question. I'm not convinced, by the way, I'm rather on your side. I'm not convinced that dark matter explains everything and there may be no alternative explanations for what you say, and there are a few other facts. For instance, closed binary galaxies tend to gravitate more than the Newtonian force would want them to gravitate. So there are some facts, and I would say that mainstream people in astronomy just decline to discuss these issues altogether, and I talk to many of them, believe me. But we are not maybe, I'm definitely not a mainstream person in astronomy, so I'm ready to discuss, but maybe after the talk, okay?
If you review your RC factor, it could be about redshift factor of 1. Equal to 1. Could you sort of explain the dark energy using because the gravitational law changes?
Well, I don't know, but I have a gut feeling that the answer is no, but I don't know. I don't know. Okay, then we have, you know what, my time is almost over because I had quite a few questions to answer, and I will be very happy to answer. So if you can give me 10 more minutes or 15 more minutes, I will try to wind up. And then there is some interesting question, which I'm really interested about gravity and intermediate distances. We can privately discuss or after that or tomorrow. Tomorrow is okay. It's Friday. Okay. Now I have to I will be very brief, because I have to show, well, it's actually not I, but it was shown even before, as I said, that putting this RC in the 10 to the 28th centimeter range, which is roughly the size of the universe, and requiring the stability with respect to radiative corrections gives you M star 10 to the minus 3 electron volt. Now you have to show this is provided that the dimensionality of the space times is bigger than 6, that is, if the number of extra dimensions is bigger than 2, which is not really a constraint these days. Now you have to show this is a number, and you have to put it through all the existing body of phenomenology to show that it's consistent with what we know from experiments. And there are, like as I said, submillimeter gravity measurements. There is particle physics, astrophysics, cosmology, and so on. So there is quite an impressive body of experiments. This number, 10 to the minus 3 electron volt, which first surfaced not at all in the context of the cosmological term, was analyzed by Dvalia Gabadadze and co-authors in a series of papers to which I just refer. I have no really any possibility to discuss them in any detail, because I have still to tell you something about the cosmological constant. And the conclusion is positive, that this number goes through the set of data, so it's empirically acceptable. With this number, gravity is modified at large distances, and also in the same manner as previously, it is modified at small distances. One of the reasons for modification at small distances, there was a question by somebody, that in fact, on the brain, what is generated is not only the Einstein-Hilbert term, but the whole infinite series of term, and since the parameter M star is small, you have to worry whether the whole infinite series of term does not produce a dramatic effect. M star is a small number, which means that this infinite series explodes at pretty large distances. This pretty large distances is translated into 10 to the minus 2 centimeters, or slightly less. So we don't know gravity at large distances. Well, at large distances, gravity becomes multidimensional. At small distances, we don't know exactly what it is in this approach, because of an infinite tower of higher dimensional terms generated on the brain, because the Sakharov's gravity with small m star is not only the Einstein-Hilbert terms, but the whole tower of terms. So we don't know. We don't know what happens at these short distances. Fortunately, the gravity is absolutely not measured at these distances. So it's okay. Whatever is there, it's okay phenomenologically. No, you do radiate some amount, but this amount goes from the data. So the star don't cool fast enough. I mean, everything is fine. Well, you have to integrate overall modes, and that's what exactly I mean. I really cannot go. I mean, this is in these papers which confront phenomenological acceptability, and we can look in these papers together. I didn't derive them. I was not a co-author, but at least I honestly went through them, and I found everything is fine. Only gravity. First of all, in this model, there are no tricks. You know, it's honest-to-God gentleman model where only gravity propagates in the bulk. So no right-handed neutrinos or anything. All particles, which we call particles, are on the brain. It's only gravity propagates on the bulk. Of course, you have to worry. You are absolutely right. You have a star on the brain, but it can then emit everything, including everything in the bulk. No, M star. It's M star. The largest, yeah, everything is cut off at M star, because from our side, from field theoretical side, we cannot go beyond M star at large. It's like the true string scale, okay? True string scale is now 10 to the... We went much further than anybody else. People first lower down the string scale from Schwartz and Scherk from 10 to the 19th GeV down to TeV, okay? And we lowered it down to, well, not particularly me, but my co-authors mostly in this aspect, they lowered it down to 10 to the minus 3 electron volt. So if you want to study gravity with momenta higher than M star, you really have to abandon field theory and you have to go to the string theory.
Huh?
So what? But you cannot measure there.
Huh?
No, but we don't know gravity because we measure only on the brain. On the brain, what we know about gravity, we know only at the intermediate distances. At the distance, we don't know gravity. If we knew gravity, if we could make on the brain a precise gravity measurement at distances of order, say, angstrom, and we would immediately discover that this gravity has nothing to do with the Newtonian gravity. In particle collisions, you measure you don't see gravity force. It's very weak force.
If the string scale is so low,
yeah,
it will be accompanied by a string halo, and will make all the amplitudes very close.
No.
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 Forget about string. I mean, at no, no, no. What I want to say that in the it's the very same question. Why graviton is not shaken off copiously in collisions, for instance, right? It's the very same question. What do you mean? What do you mean you would see? You collide, we don't have experiments with collision of gravitons because gravitational waves are not detected yet. We only can collide particles and we can have Bromstrahlung. It's the same effect as the cooling of the stars from the emission of these gravitons. So you have to take care that the Bremsstrahlung does not overwhelm the low end, the lowest order amplitude.
What I don't understand is that if the string scale is so low, so every particle, ordinary particle, electron, W and so on, will have excitation, string excitation, with spacing with millimeter.
But it's like with the photon. Every particle has a every charged particle has a cloud of photons surrounding it. So it's a normal Bremsstrahlung photon. It's the same. It's the same. It's like gravity. It's being softened at momenta larger than M star. It's being softened by, in terms of field theory, it's being softened by infinite tower of higher dimensional term, or you may say that it's being built in into the string theory. Indeed, every particle having a mass is surrounded by a Bremsstrahlung cloud of this live object, just in the same way as any electron is surrounded by an infinite cloud of photons, right? We know it, Bloch-Norsak theorem tells us. Nevertheless, there is nothing wrong with it. There is nothing wrong with it if you could see that, for instance, what happens that you collide the electrons at large moment, and you see that some number of energy with probability 1/2 disappears into nothing. Then it's a contradiction with experiment. This doesn't happen because this is a weak effect. Gravity is weak for the particles colliding on the brain. If you could make experiment, look, if you could make experiment, collide your particle off the brain, then the gravity is very strong. And then you would see it immediately. You know, for any experiment performed off the brain, you would see awful things. Everything will be screened off. There will be copious Bremsstrahlung production.
I agree with you say about gravity, but I'm worried about string scale. Because in addition to gravity, this is a string scale.
But it's the same.
No, because in addition to gravity, you will have an infinite number of string excitations.
In this model, you always have, because... In this model, I said this from the very beginning. You have it from the other side, too. The Kaluza-Klein modes have no mass gap. You have in mind a picture when the Kaluza-Klein mode or the string, which is the same as the string excitations, they have a mass gap, and therefore you can live with only one mode. Here, you always have an infinite number of modes from all sides. Right? You have to integrate over the spectrum, and you have to calculate the effect. And it's, I don't know.
Is it a question by how your scale of the brain is all the way up there? So it's a spring scale between little m star and all your standard model parameters are obviously not spring state.
No.
In this model, you can consider two string scales. One string scale for the field in the human brain, and another string scale for the cell from the human heart.
You know, in a sense, you know what, I should have probably not go into the string theory too much, because first of all, I'm not expert in that. Second of all, you are right. I mean, you are not the first person who say, okay, show me a string theory which leads to this particular type of model. And I honestly can tell you that I cannot show you the string theory with this hierarchy of parameters, okay? So I rather prefer to approach this problem from entirely field theoretic side, where it's perfectly consistent. That it's up to you guys, string theorists, to figure out whether there is a string theory which can incorporate this field theoretic construction, okay? I honestly don't know. But from field theoretic side, I can assure you that from field theoretic side, you can consider any experiment, okay, any conceivable even set of experiments, and you do not get observable deviations from, definitely there are deviations. All deviations, as a matter of fact, they are governed by this parameter R sub C. This is the expansion parameter you can show, and as long as you don't go to distances comparable to R sub C, you will have power corrections. They are not going to be logarithmic, okay? You will have power corrections to all experiments, to Newton law, to the scattering experiments, but this is a very, this is a very suppressive parameter, so it goes through experimental limitations. That's all I can say. In principle, that's an interesting topic, and in general, I would be happy if somebody gets interested from string theory side and tells me. Maybe I have a very pragmatic approach. I think that string theory is not really at the stage of development where it can dictate anything to field theorists, okay? Because it's too vague, the full solution is not known, there are infinitely many vacua, and perhaps you just don't see that a solution is possible, but perhaps it is possible. But on the other hand, it would be very interesting if somebody comes up and say, okay, here is the solution which follows this set of parameters which follows from the string theory, or here is a huge class of string theories where this solution is ruled out. Both ways it would be very, very interesting. Okay, let me finish. Now I have to return to the cosmological constant problem. This was my primary topic, but I will try to be relatively quick, although not at the expense of understandability. So what we have to do now? Now I explain to you that we have a model which has a certain Lagrangian, both in the bulk and on the brain. It has a natural value for epsilon 4, which is not particularly small, of order ms Suzy to the fourth power. And we have to see whether you have to write down the Einstein equations, which are now can never be reduced to the four-dimensional Einstein equation exactly for that reason, that the Kaluza-Klauer excitation never decouple. They're always coupled, so it's always a multidimensional Einstein equation. And you have to see whether a solution with the curved bulk, relatively curved bulk, but and relatively flat four-dimensional domain wall goes through this new Einstein equation. So the first simple thing to do, the equations are complicated. It's multidimensional Einstein equations with the source term coming from the brain, so it's not easy to solve them. Definitely there is no analytic solution. And in principle, in future studies, one has to go through the rather painful numerical calculations. I must admit that we didn't do all numerical calculations. We did estimates for various estimates, matching, various analytic pieces in various domains and matching them in between, assuming that nothing dramatic happens in the domains where the matching occurs. So the first simple thing to assume that there is no acceleration at all, just to begin with, that that our four-dimensional world is static, no, doesn't inflate. And see, in spite of the fact that epsilon 4 is large, this would be paradoxical in itself, because normally large cosmological term results in inflation which is highly non-static, okay? Here I come, I give you a large four-dimensional vacuum energy density, and I look for the solution which is in four dimensions, is static. Whatever happens in extra dimensions, it's of no concern to me. Remarkably, this solution can be found analytically. There exists such a solution. The answer is yes. You can find a solution which is fully static in our four-dimensional Wooled volume. However, at a certain distance in the perpendicular direction, it develops a naked singularity. This distance turns out to be of order of this same parameter h, which I defined in one of my previous transparencies. So it's a nice thing, but except that we don't want a singularity even in the perpendicular dimension. We want the singularity to be hidden behind the horizon. So we want to replace the singularity to be replaced by the horizon. Now, when we started thinking over the issue, at first we were quite desperate, and I should say that this work was being done in the course, it took a year probably to go through all this, and many times we were quite desperate, and many times it seemed to us that it doesn't work at all or being ruled out by experimental data. So at a certain point we realized that this singularity is maybe an artifact that we demanded the solution of the four-dimensional part of the metric to be static. It's too strong a requirement, and indeed in some other examples where people considered similar problems, the relaxation of this assumption allowed one to replace singularity, naked singularity, by the horizon. So at the next step, we allowed a slightly inflating four-dimensional world with the rate of inflation h minus 1, which happens to be of order of the Hubble constant today. And then with this relaxation and with reservations I made that it's not a rigorous mathematical statement, we found that indeed the singularity is replaced by the horizon and the original Wetterich Rubakov-Shaposhnikov idea can be implemented in this model. Now I want to give you some formulas which follow from our solution. Basically, there are two formulas which you need to know. The first expression is the expression for this distance y sub g, where either singularity develops if you impose this fully static nature in four dimensions, or it is the distance till the horizon if you relax this property. And the second and the most important formula, which is related in the solution to this parameter y sub g, is the curvature of the four-dimensional world. And here comes, this is the most surprising thing which we came to, and we couldn't believe our eyes for many, many days, but okay, so far it stands. This formula gives you the curvature of the four-dimensional world in terms of this, it follows from the solution, of course, of the Einstein equation model, all these reservations I made. It relates the curvature to the parameter m star and the vacuum energy density or the tension of the domain wall epsilon sub 4. And you see the most, usually what happens in all solutions, say if you solve the standard Einstein equation or in the standard approaches, say IDD approach, usually R4 is directly proportional to epsilon 4. The bigger the vacuum energy you input on the four-dimensional brain, the higher is the curvature. It is totally intuitive. Because you curve, the more in energy you input, through the Einstein equation, you curve the space more, okay? In this solution, that's a natural estimate, of course. That's a natural distance which develops in the problem, and the curvature is inversely proportional to the square of the distance, which is also natural. And you see that the number, if the number of the extra dimension is bigger than 2, say 3 or 4 extra dimensions, we, for some reasons, we like 4 extra dimensions, you see that the relation becomes inverse. That the higher the domain wall tension, the higher, the larger the source term you input, the smaller the four-dimensional curvature. The complete offloading occurs. What curved curves stronger, the extra dimensions curve stronger, but the four-dimensional world remains nearly flat. You have to analyze the Einstein equation. Well, you have solutions piecewise, and then you match them. Of course, this is not a, I mean, it's not, it doesn't have a mathematical degree of rigor, because when you match, when you don't know the solution in between and do matching, there is always an element of assumption here that nothing, no bifurcations or some terrible things occur, and it may well happen indeed that it occur, and only the, you know, the numerical solution of the, say, whatever, 6, 7, 8 dimensional Einstein equation can either, can, if you can do such a thing, I mean, you can either prove or disprove. So at this level, it remains more heuristic argument, or...
If you just check the Einstein equation and make n plants, which doesn't appear in this formula anymore, very small, you know that there's also this other solution where R4 goes proportional to
F. And Planck doesn't appear at all here.
But you can, I mean, if you just analyze Einstein's equation, yeah, there's this other solution which has the huge curvature on the brain.
No, that's the whole point, that you have the...
If I only have 5 gravity in the brain with tension, I know there's this Sitter solution which is strongly curved on the brain. It's an exact solution to Einstein's equation.
It's in 5 dimensions.
Yeah.
Here it's important that n bigger than...
Ah? The whole thing is supposed to be 5 dimensions.
No, but in five dimensions, you see that the relation is normal. Because in 5 dimensions...
In terms of implant, you can write down exact solution to Einstein's equation, which has an arbitrary high, I mean, very high, the Sitter curvature on the brain, which is proportional to
n. And it follows from this, because put n equal to 1, then this power is minus 1, epsilon going...
In any dimension, I can do this with proportional to epsilon before.
Only in 5.
In any, if you turn off implant on the brain, if you turn off...
That's the whole point. That's what
right, I
don't understand what you are saying. If you write a multidimensional Einstein equation, not five-dimensional, multidimensional Einstein equation, you have to analyze the solution in U. And that's the result of our analysis, which is admittedly, it's not a mathematically rigorous analysis. That's the best we could do. Either you claim that we did analysis wrong, which we are welcome to publish a paper on that, or you have to accept my word for what it is. We don't study them perturbatively. We study them piecewise. So, as I said, when you study something piecewise and do matching in between, there is always a danger that you overlooked something which has a support in this between area where you don't know your analytic solution. So, okay, we have to live with that. That's the best we can do. But if you go along the lines of naturalness and physical rigor, I would say, it's not rigor, but physical degree of our argumentation, I'm happy with what we get. No, we didn't. Here in this formula already assumes that this is a small parameter, that epsilon 4 is much larger than m star, because otherwise it gets more complicated than that, and there is no point in doing so. So, as I said, for some reasons which lie beyond the scope of this talk, we'd like to take n equal to 4. Although it's not necessary, you can have n equal even to 6. The formula works, but for some other reasons, we prefer to take n equal to 4. If you take n equal to 4, you get here the power is equal to 1, and R4 is exactly inversely proportional to epsilon to the 4. And if you plug in the numbers I quoted for m star and epsilon to the 4, which is TeV to the 4, surprisingly, from this formula again, you get exactly h squared, where h is of order of the Hubble constant. So there are two or three numerical coincidences which led us to believe that this the whole the whole thing is not so so crazy. At least it's encouraging. I don't want to say that that's the ultimate solution of the cosmological problem. Believe me, you should understand me correctly. But what I should say and what I want to say that so far it seems to be probably the first solution which is fully natural. And, okay, I mean, it invokes some assumptions. It goes for, it requires certain underlying scheme. So in this sense, it is limited. It may well be that this scheme is not supported by God. You know, it may well be that infinite volume extra dimension will brain world scenario has nothing to do with reality. But on the other hand, it may well be that neither of the brain world scenarios have anything to do with reality. We don't know. So far, there is not a single experimental indication or effect that any of these scenarios is preferred or is welcomed by nature and so on and so forth. So in the absence of this experimental indication, we may be believe that the infinite volume extra-dimensional scenario is the one realized in nature. And if so, it provides the first example, it's the existence proof, if you wish, that the cosmological constant problem can be naturally solved. And I want to conclude my talk with a parable which was told by Susskind in connection with the whole story. It's very kind of non-scientific parable, but still I like it very much. So Susskind said, assume that once upon a time there was an inflated balloon, and a population of ants developed on the surface of the balloon. These ants were confined to the surface, so they didn't know anything about perpendicular dimensions, but they were very intelligent ants, extremely intelligent ants. So they developed science, they developed physics, and they started doing experiments. Then they punched a little bit the surface of the balloon, measured the propagating wave, and from there they found the tension of the balloon. Okay? And also they measured the curvature. They measured somehow the size of the balloon, the curvature of the balloon, and they found a remarkable mismatch because the tension was very high in being measured in universe in the units of the inverse curvature. The size of the balloon was much, much larger than the corresponding tension. And then there was this terrible paradox, and they didn't know what to do, and it hindered the development of ant science for many, many years. And in fact, the solution for the paradox lied in the fact that they didn't know the existence of the inside of the balloon were filled with the excess pressure of gas. Gas was pressurized inside, and it was a totally different physics. And the pressure of the gas balanced the tension of the surface, not physics on the surface itself, but the pressure of the balance, and being measured again in the units of the curvature, this was a very abnormal pressure because the value of the pressure has to be large too. Okay? But they didn't know about this, and so they had to start to inventing all sorts of hypothetical efforts compensating for the tension, and I don't know for how long they will have to work in order to discover the pressurized gas. That's what Susskind said as a response. Thank you very much.